Hey, welcome everybody.
Let's have an AA meeting. We got a special treat tonight.
We've got not one, but two excellent speakers. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story.
My name's Alonzo, and the evidence is very clear that I'm an alcoholic. I have a great pleasure to first read this. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God, these give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Now, introduce the speaker. Okay. I understand we have two. The first one on tap is Leroy M., and I've known him, I can say, from the very moment that he came into the rooms of recovery. He's a member of my home group, Heavy Hitters. We come hard and real, and his message has depth and weight. I could tell you other stories, but time is of the essence, and I won't. And I'll tell you one other thing about him. From where he came today, among other things, he's an ordained minister. It gives me a great pleasure to introduce Leroy M.
My name is Leroy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, and I'd like to thank God for giving me a chance to have a chance today. It's because of him and you people in this room I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink, and for that I am so grateful. I want to thank Tim, and I want to thank the group for asking me to speak. My sobriety date is 9/27/1993. I am a proud member of the Heavy Hitters group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I also frequent, and we meet on Saturdays at 5 o'clock, and I also frequent the men's group at Triangle at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturdays. So a lot of times I do two meetings. You can never have enough meetings. Basically, I was born in New York. Came from a decent family. I found out later my dad had an alcoholic problem. For the most part, I didn't see a whole lot of alcohol, around. I did have my first drink when my parents threw a party one time. I was about six, and I commenced to watch cartoons, and I started drinking all the glasses that had half full drinks in them. I didn't know what they were, but I drank all of them. Ended up in the hospital with acute alcohol poisoning. But my first drink that I was aware of, had to do with me wanting to fit in, me wanting to hang with the older crowd. And you had to do some dares and things like that. So I would steal alcohol from the cupboard, pour water in it, that kind of thing. I remember eventually us, paying someone to go in the store and buy us some cold duck. That was my first real drink. And, it just began to take off from there. And now it started showing in my behavior because I was the only child up until about 10 years old. Well, I'm about 9 or 10 years old. And, I pretty much would just find myself wanting, I didn't have the older brother, and I hung around people who had older brothers. So I wanted to hang around these older guys that were doing some things. And so the first opportunity I got to do anything, and there are some other substances in my stories, and I'll try my best to keep it related to alcoholism. But I tried some other things. The one thing I know is that every time I tried other things, I either had to drink alcohol before, and I either had to drink alcohol to end. That's just how it went. It began to show up in my behavior. It began to show up in school. I would get suspended pretty much every year. And whenever I got my report card, it was always the same thing. And this is where I know today that my alcoholism was beginning, because they would always put in the comments, has no self-control. Okay? So that would, you know, continue to follow me on through life. You know, my dad looked up to him, and somewhere in the midst of my growing up, he was going out on my mom, and he would take me with him to his girlfriend's house, and they would feed me banana splits to be quiet, because I like banana splits. Later on, that became a major resentment for me, and I had to deal with that. And how it was supposed to work, you know, my parents were from North Carolina, and we decided amongst them that we were going to move back to North Carolina, but my dad was working, and he was going to work a little longer, earn some money, and come down there with us, but we were going to leave first. We left first, he never came. You know, my first major resentment began from there. How could he dare treat my beautiful mom, you know, who was the salt of the earth in my eye, the way that he did? So again, now that I'm in North Carolina, I start looking for some male figures to hang out with, you know, with this resentment and wanting to belong. And eventually there was my mom's best girlfriend, and she had a son who was a little older than me. And then he commenced to teach me how to drink properly, you know. So it started with being able to, first, we didn't have much money, so we had to steal what we had to drink. So we would go to convenience stores and steal the different kind of wines, you know, Indy 2020, Thunderbird, Roma Rocket, you know, all those different things. Richard's Wild Irish Rose, that was kind of our little drinking deal. And again, still having the issues in school, still trying some other things that probably was, you know, escalating my alcoholism. And I just continued to get in trouble in school. I ended up dropping out of school a week before graduation because there was a teacher that said they weren't going to give me a particular unit I needed to graduate. And I was like, well, what's the use then, you know? And I said that I was going to go ahead and join the Navy. But I talked to the principal first, and here's my, you know, ego and arrogancy. Like, look, he's like, why don't you just stay in school? Because he kind of knew my family, and, you know, for the most part, you know, he was going to let me graduate. But I needed to hear from him. You need to tell me, am I going to graduate? And he's like, just keep coming to school. And of course, I didn't, and then I decided to join the U.S. Navy on delayed entry. And he came to my house after I was missing for a week, and it's like, what's going on with you? And I was like, I joined the Navy. And he was like, you are so stupid. And he's like, you know, you were going to graduate. He said, but if I told you you were going to graduate, you would have went back in that lady's class and acted like an ass. And I would have. And so I went off to the Navy. And prior to that, I was very good in athletics. But again, because of my alcoholism, I didn't want to accept any scholarships. I didn't want to do scholastics. I know I made my coaches laugh one time because they was like, you know, you got these letters, you know, you're going to take. I don't want to do any more, you know, school scholastics stuff. I don't want people to tell me what to do. And they're like, oh, so you're joining the Navy, but you don't want people to tell you what to do. So, you know, I ended into the Navy. And, you know, that was like, you know, the next level of drinking. It was like expected, you know. It was like a badge of honor to drink in the Navy. And I know that one of the deals were I was about to go, most of the time it was like I was going to schooling for the most part. And then there had been an occasion where I would always, well, not an occasion, several occasions, I would be late all the time, which would be an unauthorized absence. And I would get a lot of them. And so I had to go in front of captain's mass, and the person that I went in front of had been one of the Iranian hostages, and he had gotten released, and they had given him his command in Virginia Beach. So I had to go face this guy, and you know, and he's like, you know, well, you know, you're going to get this, you know, it was like reduction in rank, you know, extra duty, fines, you know, the whole nine. And when I was leaving out, I was like, you know, I don't want this guy to think I'm some kind of, you know, a knucklehead. You know, I'm going to go back in here and tell him, you know, who I really am. And so I went back and I was like, look, I'm a good, you know, well, not soldier. I'm a good cadet, whatever. And you know, and I, you know, I just don't want you to think I'm some kind of, you know, bad sailor, da 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 da. And he's like, Admiral Murphy, I respect you coming back here and telling me that, but that's not going to change anything. what I know today is that while I was out drinking and different things that I did, the God of my understanding was always looking out for me in the midst of all of my mess. And this was one of the first signs. And so I end up going to meet the executive officer. And the executive officer, you know, he's, you know, giving us this welcome aboard speech. And then he tells everybody to leave. It was like five of us. And he says, Airman Murphy, you stay. And I'm like, what did I do? I just got here. And, you know, he says, I got a good report from Commander Sherry. And he thinks you're going to be a great sailor. And if anything ever happens, you know, always come to me and we'll try to take care of things. And I didn't know how significant that would be because no sooner than I got done with that, I'm getting ready to go out, you know, on my first med cruise on an aircraft carrier. And my girlfriend at the time throws me a party. And we drank this thing called PJ. I don't know if a lot of you know about that. Some of the older crowd may. But what PJ is that you take 191 grain proof alcohol and you pour it in a cooler and you throw fruit in there. And you might put a little bit of Kool-Aid in there, and you drink it. And that's what we did. And I missed the ship, which is a major offense. And they had to fly me to the ship in, to Sicily, Italy. So I got to the ship, and people were like, oh, you're going to so get it. And so now it gets better because the actual commander of my squadron was the commander who shot down two of Gaddafi's MiGs. So he's real gung-ho. And so I go in front of him, and I get ripped again. You know, you're going to get dropped in rank, you know, X number days, extra dues, blah, 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 blah. So I'm holding my head down, and the executive officer says, what's wrong, Murphy? He's like, did you hear that? He's like, all of it was suspended. I never heard the suspended part. So as long as I didn't get in any trouble, none of that stuff really happened, except I did have to stay on the ship when they went to Venice. And I got to miss that particular port. I know that one of the funny things about being on the aircraft carrier was, you know, you're on there like anywhere from 30 to 45 days at a time before you pull in the land. So when you pull in, you got maybe one day, possibly 2 days to kill. And I used to, so when we got off, I would see these chicken wire fences of like mummy cages, you know, and I was like, what are those for? And one of the guys who'd been on cruises for a while, he says, wait till later tonight. And because, you know, we're on there with Marines, the whole nine, and then when we come from drinking, and I know the Admiral, he would come on the loudspeaker and tell us before we left, you know, go on Liberty, have a good time, and don't drink the ouzo. Well, being the alcoholic that I am, was ouzo. And they're telling me, oh, it's this opium-based liquor. I was like, we've got to get some. And so, you know, and then when we get there, you know, the first thing I say, you know, we're going to a bar and we're going to order a drink of ouzo. And I'm like, look, forget all of that. How much for the bottle? Okay, so that's where I know my alcoholism is escalating. Then also, we had a keen idea. We would go to the store that we could go to. I'm forgetting what we call it, but we would all go and you can get the alcohol very cheap. PX. And we can get the alcohol very cheap. And so it was about maybe 20 of us. And we all decided that we would all buy a different alcohol and drink it all together. Okay? So, you know, now when we get ready to go back to the ship, you find out what those cages are for because people want to jump in the water. They want to swim back to the ship, you know, all kinds of neat stuff. Needless to say, I continued to still get in trouble. I remember this same executive officer was like, look, you know, you're real close to getting kicked out. He's like, what I can do for you is I can offer you, and I've only been in about 18 months, he said, I can offer you a full, you know, discharge package with benefits where you can leave now. And, you know, and I told him, I said, give me a day to think about it. Like, I had a choice. And, I came back the next day and said, I'll take it, and got discharged, came back out into the world, came home for a brief moment. Went to stay with my dad in New York now. So he wants to allow me to come up to New York and stay with him. And I still got this resentment lingering. We don't get along real well. He eventually had to kick me out, you know, because I'm doing some really wild stuff. You know, stealing, talking bad to him. You know, I think I beat up one of his roommates. And this, you know, real crazy alcoholic behavior. When he ended up calling a girl that I grew up with next door. And it just so happened she was in recovery in another fellowship. And he had told her, you better come get him if you care anything about him. And she came and she got me, and she took me to a meeting in New York, down in the Village. And, you know, they would give you three hots and a cot, and, you know, and you had to go to meetings. I got a job at McDonald's on Times Square, first check. I was back out there, you know, on the Bowery again. I was homeless, and truly homeless, to the point of, you know, I would, you know, miss, you know, you had an opportunity to get in shelters, I would miss bed checks, so then you're just out on the street. And I would, like, wait for the old donuts from the Dunkin' Donuts to be thrown out in the morning for breakfast. For dinner, you might, you know, go to one of those Pizza Hut pan pizza places, and they would throw out all the old pizzas, and you'd search for the warm trash bag to, you know, just to find something to eat that way. You know, and then sometimes I even dug out of a trash can if I could find a half a sandwich that was, you know, not really that bad, and do what I had to do. I drank water from the fire hydrant. That's what I did. By being a veteran, I was allowed to be able to do some street vending, and they paid me a lot of money, you know, to do some street vending, to use my license, and that only allowed my alcoholism to escalate more and more. Finally, I, you know, told the guys I was working for I couldn't do it anymore, and I needed to go back home to Carolina, and they actually saw me off to the Port Authority and sent me home. Prior to that, I took a stab at some recovery by going to the Veteran Hospital in Northport, Long Island, and I would tell them these stories about how I worked for these guys, you know, vending, and they would pay me, you know, I would have like $1,000 on my hand a day, and they're going to pay me $200 of it. And they said, you never stole all the money? And I was like, no, because they're going to pay you another $200 the next day. And they kicked me out because they said I really didn't have a problem. And I begged them. I was like, don't send me back out there. I got a problem. So I was back out there. Got to North Carolina. I grew up with friends that worked for beer companies. We never had to really buy any alcohol. I mean, they worked for Budweiser and Miller, and they would just take a case of beer and throw it on the ground and say, damaged case, we get to drink it, you know, and that's how we, you know, continued to drink. And then I started, as I started escalating, where I hang out in bootleg houses, you know, and they would cook food, and, you know, you buy your liquor and hang out and all of that neat stuff. I ended up meeting a guy at one of these bootleg spots that was from Atlanta, and at the time I didn't know he was a telemarketing kingpin. And he was like, "Ah, man, you got to skip the gab, you know." He's like, "Man, I got guys down there in Atlanta. They're making like $2,000 a week talking like you talking." I'm like, "Yeah." And he offered me this deal. He's like, "Look, if you come down and you don't like it, he said, I'll send you back." And he gave me a plane ticket. I came to Atlanta. I went into this boiler room, and they were lying, and they were getting paid for lying, and I lied pretty good. And I made $1,500 a week. That was 1989. I've never left. That just allowed me, I thought when I was homeless that I'd hit my bottom. And during that time I was homeless, I hung in some real bad areas, and I'd had gums put to my head and things like that. And for the grace of God, nothing ever happened. So I figured that would be my bottom. But, you know, it wasn't, because now I was making a lot more money, you know, and being just as bad. So it didn't matter whether I had money or not. The disease still did what it does. And, you know, eventually I ended up, you know, hanging out again in places I shouldn't have been hanging in, and getting picked up by the Red Dog and, you know, and all these different police agencies. And I started going to jail. You know, first it was, you know, they released me on my own reconnaissance. The next time, you know, it was like, okay, you know, we're going to put you on house arrest. And I would have to, they would call, and I'd have to run to the phone, and they'd have a button I'd push, and they'd take a picture of me. And then while I was blowing in a breathalyzer, you know, and they would do a voice check and all this stuff. So I'd have to do it every time the phone rang. And I did good for a while. Then I had this keen idea that I would drink some non-alcoholic beer. That would be the ticket, you know, which non-alcoholic beer has 0.5% alcohol in it. And if you drink enough of it, you could get a buzz. You could get drunk. I drank a case of it. You know what I mean? So at that point, it was no need of me. I wasn't answering the phone no more. I did an Everything Must Go sale. My wife at the time, I just had a newborn son, and she went up to New York to show it, you know, to hang out with her mom. And I stole everything in the apartment, and they had nothing to come back to. My probation officer, I had been missing for a while on the bench, and she, you know, she told me to come on in, and She asked me, had I been, you know, using it? And I was like, you know, a little something here or there. She said, come on in, no problem, we'll talk about it. And when I got down there, she locked me straight up. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. And this last particular time, they were going to make me stay in jail until there was a spot open in Mar. And at the time, Mar had a 6-month waiting list. I'm like, I can't be in here, because I'm sitting in and I'm listening to these guys' stories about, oh man, I know how I got in here. If I hadn't have been doing this or that, and the next time I go out there, I'm going to do it this way. And I'm like, this is crazy, and I'm in here with them, so it makes me pretty crazy. Eventually, by the grace of God, they ended up releasing me to a treatment center. And I was supposed to report straight to that treatment center. And I didn't report straight to the treatment. Well, I caught a cab from Lindbergh, and there was some relatives of my wife that we used to drink with. And I figured I'd let them know I was out. So, but I said, I want to get out the cab. And I pulled up the window and had them, I said, hey, I'm out, you know. And here's where the mental obsession kicks in. Because as soon as I said, hey, I'm out, the whole ride to my apartment, all I was thinking about was, you know, I want to go ahead and I want to start partying. And as soon as I got to the house, I called them. And it took off. I never made it to the halfway house. Finally, I did make it, you know, a couple of days later. They said, you were supposed to be here a few days ago. We're going to leave it up to the group to decide whether or not we're going to let you stay. And I figured, hey, they're alcoholics like me. You know, they'll understand. And the first person says, screw him. If he ain't serious about his recovery, send him back to jail. And that petrified me. I did not want to go back to jail. They did let me stay. And then I ended up, they ended up making us go to mandatory meetings at the Triangle Club. And it was my very first meeting was the men's group of Triangle Club at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I would go, and I was a pretty angry person. But this particular day, I heard a guy share, and he shared with some depth and weight. He shared about doing some things I had done, being some places I had been, and that his life was better and he had peace. Peace caught my attention because I had not had peace in a long time. You know, when it talks about inner conceding to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, I never had a problem with that. I was clear. My problem was I couldn't stop. So I listened to this person, and at that moment, I realized that I could no longer listen to me. That was my moment of clarity. You're not going to get this program if you try to listen to Leroy. So at that moment, whatever somebody told me to do, I did it. Because I heard somebody say, if you do what we do, you'll get what we got. So that's how I commenced to doing that, and I began to hang out before the meeting and after the meeting. That was critical. And then one day, they decided they were going to go have sushi. I'd never had sushi in my life, didn't even know what it was. But what I knew is when I was hanging with these people, I wasn't drinking. And that's what was most important. And I started hanging out with them, and I knew as long as I hung with them, I wasn't drinking. I got me a sponsor. I started working the steps. When I got to that fourth step, I had the opportunity of being able to address my resentment with my dad and to understand that I don't know how my dad was raised. I don't know, you know, what his life was like. And I was able to forgive him, okay, and I was able to see that maybe I was being a little bit too hard on him not knowing. You know, later on, as I began to work the steps, I also had to come to terms with some of my character defects, and one of them was lust. And I had this idea that, you know, if I gave up my lust, that it was going to somehow affect my libido. And so that was one of those I wasn't going to touch. And it tells us that we're not supposed to have any reservations and not say never. Because later on, that same defect came to eat my lunch. And I had to drop to my knees and ask God. I was like, you take my lust. I don't care what you do with it. I'll be celibate for 5 years if you want me to. I ended up being celibate for 3.5. Wasn't my idea. wasn't my idea. But it really taught me some things about women, and because I had gotten divorced, it taught me something different about women and wanting to be in a relationship. Things went on. I continued to work the steps, making amends. One mistake I made making amends is making amends to an ex-girlfriend. I suggest you truly stay close to your sponsor when you decide to do that, ex-girlfriend, ex-boyfriend, because after I made the amends and paid back what I owed, you know, some other things happened that probably shouldn't have. So that's something that I highly suggest you don't do. And then later on, you know, once I started making those amends, I didn't want to have to dig enough. I heard a friend of mine say the quickest way to get out of a hole, stop digging. And so that 10th step was real important to me. And one of the things that helped me with my 10th step was in the mornings reading the daily reflection, because it was like a mini meeting starting my day. Okay, and I also started going on retreats and workshops. They talk about doing annual and semi-annual cleanings. That's kind of helped me. You know, in the end, you know, of course, my relationship with God, and I'm going to hurry up and wrap this up so I can leave some time for the other speaker. One of the other things that happened for me when I got around to step 11, you know, I started getting my relationship a little closer with God, and you know, I probably had a little bit of time at this time, but I remember saying to myself, you know, I wish I could be a little bit closer, you know, to the God of my understanding. I'm so busy, I don't have time. Well, not too soon after that, I got stricken with kidney disease and lost total function of my kidneys, and I had to do dialysis, and I did dialysis from home. So, for four times a day, for at least an hour, I had to be completely still and spend time with God, and I did that for 3.5 years. It did wonders for me. Later on, I was blessed with a kidney transplant. The whole thing of working these steps started building a foundation for me, because, you know, life is going to continue to happen. When trouble comes, we still have to have something that we can take and lean and depend on, and the program is in the book, and it will allow you to do that. 10 years ago, come next month, I lost my 9-year-old daughter in a car accident. She was my youngest. I lost two other family members as well, and it was a home group. And you people in these rooms that held me up during that time. And, you know, they asked me to do things and to do service. And those kind of things helped me to get through that time. Later on, through that, I ended up, you know, being able to be called into the ministry. And that's allowed me, because, I was able to go back to the church in my youth. And that was a direct result of this program. It helped me to reconnect with my God, even though I was brought up in the church. And I gotten far away, I was able to reconnect. And then I saw some other people that needed help as well. So it's allowed me to do service in and outside the program. And I'm extremely, extremely grateful for that. You know, I've gotten remarried to a beautiful woman who's also in the program, so that's a lot of fun. And, you know, my life's better than it's ever been, in spite of all the tragedies and all the tribulations I've gone through. There's been triumphs behind each and every one of them. And that's a direct result of working these steps and helping other alcoholics recover in this program. So I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous was here when I got here, and I continue to be a member so that I could be here for someone else. Thanks.
And Leroy, fantastic. Thanks. I know you helped an alcoholic in here tonight. Hey, if you got to get up, that's fine. But we're going to go on and move into our second speaker, trying to economize on time. Brian is going to do the introduction.
Hey, family, again, Brian Price, alcoholic. Our next speaker is a friend, a colleague, and a guy I know in and out of the rooms. Through my time in the program, he's really one of my closest friends today. I'm not going to say anything else. This is Red.
Everyone, I'm Brett Mercer. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 21st, 2011. My home group is the Fifth Tradition Group. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And I sponsor a bunch of guys right now. And life is good with that. You guys are getting a double dose of a couple northern guys tonight for speakers. I'm actually originally from Boston, so we have a little New York Boston rivalry going on, I guess, tonight. Yankees fan, Leroy?
Oh, Mets.
Sorry, you got us in 86. I won't spend too much time on kind of the early childhood stuff, but I was privileged beyond anything I could have or anyone could have ever asked. I was born into a family that was fairly wealthy, big Irish Catholic family on one side and a big Protestant family on the other side. So I had lots of uncles, lots of aunts, lots of cousins. And both my parents growing up were kind of the two outcasts of their families. They're the two kind of minimalist drinkers of these big, large families. And growing up, you know, the potential alcoholic I was, I had my own set of issues with unrest, but as my folks' marriage kind of deteriorated, at somewhere along the line, I made this connection that, well, I see how unhappy they are in the home front, but all my aunts and uncles are the drinkers, and when we get together for big family functions, they're always the ones that are having the most fun, the most energetic, the most charismatic. And I did like Leroy. I started, you know, sneaking beers and stuff like that when I was like 6 years old, and you know, definitely had made some sort of connection that a Budweiser can in your hand was equal to happiness and something that I wanted. You know, the book talks about being restless, irritable, and discontent. So I guess I'll give you a couple snapshots of what that looked like in my childhood. And I'm fortunate that I have some family friends that told me about how early it had started, because I had no idea. I wore a down, puffy winter vest year-round from like age 2 to 4, because it was the thing that was going to protect me against all the bad guys. You know, I was in a constant state of fighting the world, essentially, and I guess some of that's natural for a young boy, but you know, when you start getting kicked out of school at 3 years old for pushing kids off the jungle gym, I guess in retrospect, my parents should have been, you know, putting $2 aside for rehab and only one for college. With being ADD and potentially alcoholic as a child, I presented with a whole bunch of good, you know, behavioral and boundary issues, and continue today to have some good boundary issues in spite of this program. But one of the unique experiences that I thought of recently was my folks started sending me to psychologists at like age 5. And I had this guy, Dr. Joe, when I was like 5 to 7 years old, something like that, and used to kind of try to work through all the stuff. And my parents then forced me back to go to psychologists and stuff like that once my drinking career had progressed to 21. And I didn't remember this, but he informed me that I had put permanent damage in the floor of his office that he was still in when I was 7, when they did this like exercise where they put some light bulbs in a plastic bag and give you a hammer and see how aggressive you are when you beat them up. And apparently I was doing all sorts of like kung fu moves, jumping up and down. And literally, you know, whatever it was, 15 years later, he showed me the dents that were still in his floor that I put there. And so for me, kind of being in this constant state of just ready to fight the world and really uncomfortable with myself pretty much characterizes my childhood in spite of having so many great things, you know, kind of handed to me, if you will. My parents did a really good job. They threw me into, you know, schools that had really great educational opportunities, you know, gave me opportunities to learn about my passions for sports and arts and all sorts of good stuff. And for a while, I really kind of, in spite of a lot of behavioral stuff, it was tracking pretty good with the rest of the folks. And then I got to the end of middle school, sometime in middle school, and I took it upon myself that drinking was something that I wanted to start doing because some of the cooler kids were doing it. And in a very short time, I was able to undo everything that had been given to me. My first drink was characterized by getting away with it, even though all three of us were throwing up. I got drunk. We had two foreign exchange students staying with us for actually Memorial Day weekend. They spoke very little English. They were two Japanese guys. We filled up all the liquor in these big highball glasses and then put just this much Coca-Cola on top of some sort of gin, vodka, scotch concoction. And they each had about half of theirs, and then I drank my whole one and finished theirs, and all three of us were found the next morning having thrown up and passed out. We claimed it was the roast beef subs and got away with it until the next month when my dad sat me down and asked me to explain a $500 cable bill because I had proceeded to order every porno that was playing on the TV. At which point he knew that there was some sort of behavioral stuff going on, probably because he told me I was smarter than that. I always got away with stuff, so there must have been some other reason. So I got sober at 26, and I'd say that whereas a lot of people, you know, in AA have lost many things that were dear to them, I never had an opportunity to experience a lot of those awesome things until I got sober. So essentially, my alcoholism kept me from really getting into living real life. And I got kicked out of a private school and lost my opportunity to go to a really, really solid college because I was selling pot to fit in, and also because I liked the way it made me feel in high school. I got sent home early from a semester abroad at a prestigious college in England. My very first year of college, I went over there, and actually I took a year off to try to get back into that college, and I got fired from a teaching internship for smoking pot, and then got sent home early because I cut my hand open drunk and stoned in a pub in England, messing around with kitchen knives. And so you might say that there's all these opportunities that either failed or never really got started because my disease was growing. It was crazy. I also left college in Southwest Connecticut at Fairfield University. A lot of my buddies were Yankees and Mets fans down there, and left college after I'd kind of gone on like a 6-month bender, my first ever real alcoholic, drug induced bender, where for every day for 6 months I got tore up until I couldn't anymore, and thought that that was probably the bottom. My parents shipped me off to rehab at 21. That was my first little taste of AA and kind of treatment, and that there's a world of people out there that wanted to be sober. And 2 months after that, I relapsed the day I got out. And 2 months after that, I got in a really bad car accident. I used to tell it as a funny story. I went, and I'll give you the newspaper quote. Oakley Road man drives the wrong way around the circle of death, almost killing 3 people on himself. He was quoted as saying, "There was no way I was driving that car. I'm way too wicked fucking hammered." That's my claim to fame, right? It's my alcoholism. The only thing that's ever been published on me is an article about me almost killing 3 people and me being quoted as lying at it, right? Being dishonest. And most people would have probably most people would have reached out to those folks to apologize. Most people would have looked for a different solution. I had left the scene of that accident because I was looking for self-preservation because I had a lot of drugs and alcohol in the car. Got away from the cab driver, sort of, ended up doing what every scared kid does and drove back to my parents' house, hid all the stuff in the woods. The cab driver had slowly been following me in his damaged vehicle. Ended up going to jail that night, and the first thing I reached for the next morning was the drugs and alcohol that I had hid in my parents' bushes. And that pretty much is the story of me. I always reach for something no matter what. So at 21 years old, with on serious probation and not much hope for myself or from anybody else that loved me, I went and worked for a mafia-owned restaurant in Boston, and surrounded myself with convicted felons, guys that liked to party and do drugs like I did. And that's the part of the book where I had arrived. I was with a fast-moving crew of people. They told me that I needed to start carrying a knife because if things were to go down, and this is a kid that went to private school and was raised in an upper class, kind of preppy family, all of a sudden I'm going, yeah, that makes perfect sense. I got to protect myself, and that's where the delusion kind of set in. Or kind of looking back, I know that that delusion was in full effect at that point. I worked for them for about a year and a half, with luckily not really getting into too many scrapes with the police or other people, and had an opportunity to move to Georgia. My dad had taken a job down here, and I jumped at it. I said, whatever, geographical career, I'm going to get new friends. It's all where I'm at and a whole string of bad events. I moved down here and started working for a restaurant group, and then also got a job, had somehow weaseled my way into
teaching at a private charter school downtown, trying to educate kindergarten through ninth graders. And very quickly at that job, I'm showing up, you know, having been up till 5, 6 in the morning drinking, showing up at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, still drunk, too drunk to probably work, and definitely having done some outside issues that, you know, get you woken up in the morning when you've been drinking a little too much. So after that year, you know, there's talk of whether or not I was going to come back to teach there, and I had my first kind of moment of clarity, not necessarily about needing to change the way I was drinking or partying, but that being a balding, overweight, 23-year-old drug addict and an alcoholic gym teacher wasn't necessarily what I would have wanted out of my life. So something had to go, so I quit teaching. That was the easiest fix, because everything else was either I was stuck with or definitely wasn't willing to give up. So worked in the restaurants for about 3 years down here. Had found this nice kind of balance, if there is such a thing, as a, you know, disease of alcohol progresses. I guess I was in kind of like a good point where I was willing to deal with whatever those consequences and that, you know, kind of progression downward looked like for those 3 years, and was able to maintain a job. Took a couple hostages in the form of girlfriends that were not alcoholic, and immediately made them codependent to my alcoholism. And you know, during that time, it wasn't necessarily some tragic event that happened again. They got me into the rooms. It was the last year of my drinking looked like a constant fight with a girlfriend, my family not wanting to talk to me, my friends basically only calling me for birthdays and breakups because they knew I'd be down to get messed up the way that they wanted to on those two special occasions that some regular people like to drink to excess on. And my physical health, you know, had deteriorated to the point where I was throwing up blood every day for over a year, every day. And I thought that was normal, or I thought that that was something I could handle. And I just got tired. I got tired and hopeless. And you know, sometimes, you know, I heard this guy say that you know, bee stings and bullet wounds can feel the same to different people. And so I don't have one of those really hardcore events that triggered me kind of coming into the rooms. It was just a whole bunch of bee stings that had kind of got me here over the last 3 or 4 years that finally I'm going, something's got to change. So I went to, got to Petrie Hospital, and you know, as dark and gloomy as a treatment center is, it's amazing that spiritual experiences can occur in there every day. I heard a guy that looked hopeless tell my story up to the age of 26, and I'm 31 now, by the way, and then he told me what happened to him from 26 to 45, and it was horrifying, and I really didn't want to end up like him. I didn't know it at the time, but I had a spiritual experience in Petrie, one of those white light variety ones, and I didn't know it at the time, nor was I willing to even admit that there was potentially God involved in what I felt. But I had a social worker ask me a very simple question: are you willing to go to 90 meetings in 90 days? And I had already executed a game plan that was, I was going to go to AA and go to outpatient and do all these things. And that question broke me. I said, immediately started saying, Thanksgiving and Christmas are coming up. There's no way I could possibly commit to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I stopped. And it wasn't me talking. And it was like the mother of all like pins and needles. Like I had sat like on like one of my foot wrong for like a day solid, and I felt this like warm energy come through me, and there it was. The words came out: I need help. I'm an alcoholic. And at that time, that was like the most depressing thing. I thought being an alcoholic meant I drank too much and that I had like low moral standards. What I've come to realize through working the steps, through getting into the book, and working with a sponsor, is that being an alcoholic means a couple things. It means that I have a disease of mind and body. A lot of people throw around the, you know, kind of analogy to cancer. I like to think that this disease is something that is more like Alzheimer's. It's something that exists in my family. You know, I'm going to die an alcoholic with the disease of alcoholism, no matter what, whether it's an active addiction, sober, you know, or you know, otherwise. And it's going to continue to progress where it progresses to, I don't know. Hopefully, you know, I never have to find that out if I can continue doing what I've done to stay sober up until this point. Yeah, I don't want to know what my alcoholism looks like if it gets a chance to come back out, because this thing is still working. The more time that I spend in these rooms, the more scared I am of it, because it just means that it's gotten stronger underneath the surface, and I really can't see what it looks like. I'll try to just talk a little bit on service work. That's the most important thing in my life today. I was writing a letter today on behalf of a sponsee to a judge and two prosecutors, having to, one, describe myself and why they should be reading my letter and taking into consideration anything I have to say, and two, describing a man that I saw in the worst of shape, and I've also seen him at this more recently best of times. And that triggered a few different emotions for me. One, when I reread the letter when I was editing it for grammar and such, so that I can make sure I sounded like I was representing a 12-step program of recovery eloquently, I didn't recognize the man that I had described. Yet everything that I wrote about myself is true. And that was a really cool experience for me. I also, almost through, maybe I threw like a couple tears at my desk when I was describing the experience that I had gotten to watch in another member of this program that I've had the privilege to sponsor. And understanding that watching that fellowship grow up around us and having a host of friends has absolutely happened in my life. It says in the book that we absolutely, when all else fails, working with another alcoholic saves the day. And that has been my experience time and time again. I have turned away from prayer. I have turned away from service work at certain points in early recovery. But yet always working with another alcoholic has saved the day. My sponsor first told me when I was like 3 weeks sober, and by the way, I am that guy that was stuck up enough to think that when you go to treatment centers and then they force you to go to AA, that you all were going to fix me and the high-priced counselors were here to fix me, and all I had to do was show up and say, all right, talk to me, do whatever it is that you do. But the sponsor, my first sponsor, shook my world, and I believed it. 3 weeks in, he said, it's not about you, it's about helping everybody else. He said, right now you can help a guy with one day, a week, whatever. You got more time than them. You've had this much more experience. You finally asked them to sponsor you, and you've met me twice. You've read the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. You can share on that if you want to talk to someone. Other than that, you're really good for showing up early, setting up chairs, and staying late and breaking them down. And that was what I had to offer at the very beginning. As I grew in experience through working the steps and having cleared away a lot of the wreckage that I caused through, you know, doing a sound and really in-depth fourth and fifth step, and then moving on to doing a really serious ninth step because I had harmed a lot of people, I found out that I was of use in other ways in God's light, and that's my truth today, is that God has allowed me the opportunity to help people in ways that I could have never imagined because I lived out of self for so long. Now, I'm a good alcoholic, so I also love some of the program, the things that this program has given me, don't get me wrong, but the best thing that has happened from AA is that I've learned about how I'm capable to help others. I went to a men's retreat recently where most of the sobriety was 25 plus years, and I made mention of how cool it was to be around that much time. And one of the crustier old timers there said, it's not about the time, thinking that he was going to teach me a lesson or give me something to chew on for a minute. The reason why I was in shock of it was because I had known that how much I've helped some people over the last 4 years and could only imagine how many people that a guy with 38 years could have helped, how many different alcoholics he may have touched, whether he knows it or not. That was the really cool part. The scary part was also seeing that one crusty alcoholic and a couple others that had kind of rested back and said, I've done enough. All I need to do is show up to my meetings on occasion and make sure I'm talking to a few other guys that have this time. And their quality of life was like black and white compared to the guys that were talking about, my home group is a beginner's meeting, you know, this, that, and the other. And that's something that is amazing to me, is that it's about working with each other. God works through other people in my life constantly. I see that. I'm kind of like a I don't know, I'm not good with dogs, but I'd probably be like the dumbest breed of dog if I was one, because I typically don't even recognize whether I'm being helpful or hurtful. I just kind of go through life, and when I was out there drinking, I definitely was hurtful, but more times than not, because I'm following the suggestions that were laid out to me from the beginning and until now, the same. I found out that I've been able and fortunate enough to have made an impact on some people's life in a positive way. When I was a kid, I loved being able to teach people something, whether it was a younger kid and as a camp counselor setting or even that alcoholic year teaching. I did get a lot of joy out of helping others. God had other plans for me when he made me, because he made me uniquely qualified to specifically help and potentially teach another alcoholic something that I have experienced. And I'm really grateful for that today. It is where I get my source of strength. It is the thing that drives my moral compass, hopefully as north as it can go, and is absolutely the thing that keeps me grounded when everything else kind of, you know, flies off in a hurricane. I'm able to kind of, you know, stay put even when my emotions are taking me somewhere where I normally would have gone had I been drinking. So I want to be respectful of your guys' time. Thank you for letting me speak a minute or two.
Thank you, Rhett. Frankly, after that, I really do give a damn. Mike C., would you please get out the chips?
Hey, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. At the Blue Chip Speaker meeting, as most AA meetings, we have a chip system to know our time in sobriety. Designates quantity, but hopefully there's quality also as you go along. First, if you're you'd like to try this way of life, or you're coming back after some experimentation, we offer the white chip. If anybody is wanting to give it a try tonight, anybody for the white chip? Okay, we'll leave it up here if you feel more comfortable stealing it after the meeting. Well, that was me starting off. If you have 30 days and nights in a row, we have the silver chip. Anybody with a month? Okay. 90 days, we have the red chip. You have a little blood in your alcohol stream. Nobody? Okay. In 6 months, we have yellow. Anybody? Okay. What about 9 months for green? That's a tough one. Okay. Anybody else? 9 months? And we have years or multiples of years? Anybody?
Do I get to speak?
You'll have to.
My name is Owen Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know how you do it here. Briefly, around about this time of year, every year I try to reflect a little bit on, you know, how I got to this point. And this year I was thinking that a big reason why I'm still sober is that I'm always aware that I'm an alcoholic. It's always present in my mind. I'm not obsessing about it, but it's always there. I don't push it back in the back of my mind. And that's very important to me, because I see a lot of people doing that, and they'll do anything to try to forget it, and then they're gone, and then they're drunk, and then we read about them in the obituaries. And I think part of that is that I kind of enjoy being an alcoholic. I like being an alcoholic. I like being, I don't really like being normal. And I like being a little cockeyed, you know, preferably sober. The other thing I think that's very important to my sobriety is that I don't have any resentments against anybody in AA. And I make sure I don't. I can't afford to walk in that door and see somebody in the room that makes me uncomfortable to be around. because I have a resentment or I've done something to make that person resentful towards me. Because I earned my seat in here, and that, you know, I need to be there and be comfortable in that seat and in whatever group setting I'm in. And I just don't, if I get a resentment against somebody, I make sure that I do what the program says that I need to do to take care of that, you know, pretty quickly. So those are two things on my, you know, kind of reflections this year about what's gotten me this far. I thank God and all you people for everything that you've given to me. Thank you.
Sorry.
How many?
30.
30?
Yeah.
All right. We have any other birthdays? Okay. In case the applause woke you up, anybody reconsider on the white chip? Okay. Well, thank God for the chip you hold.
Thank you, Mike. Again, really fantastic. Thanks. I know you have an alcoholic in here tonight. And again, really fantastic.
Like his kid.